excited to tell you that we're part of the Heart of Wisdom Melbourne group, and I'd like to express my gratitude to everyone who really put it together to get everything set up and all the promoting and everything that's been happening. So thank you very much. And the Heart of Wisdom Melbourne Middleway is one of, Middleway Centre is one of Lama Maru's eight centres throughout the world, and Lama Maru's our spiritual director, and the Middleway Centres aim to give us practical ways to incorporate the wisdom of these wonderful teachings into our lives now, right here. We don't have to be anywhere else. And these talks, the next three, are on the Heart Sutra. So this first one tonight, and it's one of the Middleway courses, goes from, as we know, from 7:30 to 9:30, and then there are two tomorrow, that one that goes from 12:30 to 2:30, and the second one from 4 to 6, and then the final one, sorry, 4, not 3, on Sunday from 4 to 6. And then we've got some other talks happening on Monday night as well, and you would have received this flyer. So Cindy Lee speaking on purifying pride and jiu-jitsuing jealousy, and that's at our home at 24 Union Street, Armidale. So you're all very welcome. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is also a talk for the for the under 25s, and that's also at our house, and that's from 5 to 6 p.m. On Monday as well. And then coming up, we've got a retreat at the ashram at Rockland down near Dalesford, and that's from the 14th to the 17th of November. So that's on devotion. So you can go through our website to register. I think the click-on's working now. And then, or you can go to the ashram site and register there as well. And then, yeah, so that's the things that are happening with Heart of Wisdom. There's also this flyer which has all the details on it as well. So, yeah, hopefully there's enough flyers around so you can get them before you leave. And I wanted to also just, the main thing I wanted to do was introduce to you all to Lama Maru. and Lama Maru's a motorbike enthusiast and author of a great book that we have for sale down the back there called The Spiritual Renegade's Guide to the Good Life. He's a former surfer, a magpie supporter, and a professor of comparative religions, and he's also trained in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So he comes to us with a wealth of information, knowledge and experience, and his teachings have really totally changed my life, and I am so grateful, and hopefully my family are grateful too. And I'd really like to thank you, Lama Maru, very much for coming to teach us.
Thank you. Only in Melbourne could you get an introduction that would include being a magpie supporter. When I first came to Australia and was I hired an adjuster, is that what you call him, to help buy a house, lawyer guy. And he said, oh, well, if you're going to live in Australia, you've got to be a football fan. And I said, well, I don't know anything about Aussie rules football. He says, that's all right, I'll just assign you a team. So he assigned me Collingwood. And then I found out that Collingwood was the most hated football team. And the most loved, of course. Yeah, so. Anyway, it's good to be back in Melbourne with old friends and new. And as Marie said, this is the first of four classes, a series of classes, on one of the world's greatest spiritual texts, one of them, called the Heart Sutra. Each class will be sort of self-contained, so you're welcome to take them all or drop in as you can over the weekend. This is one of a course that will form a curriculum that we're building for our centers, Middleway Centers, one of which is here in Melbourne. And each course has four classes, and I'll try to keep my remarks to about an hour and a half. So you know, it's always good to know like how long you have to sit, right? And then if there are questions or comments at about 9 o'clock, we can spend some time doing that. And each of these classes has an exercise that goes with it. So in the curriculum that I went through studying Tibetan Buddhism, there were homeworks and quizzes and final exams. And no one did them, except for me. I did them. And so, you know, I'm trying out the exercises thing to see if that'll work. And the exercises aren't, you know, they're not quizzes. They're not, you don't get scored on them. You don't get, you know, graded. But they are meant to take kind of what we have discussed in each of these classes and give you some opportunity to put it into work, put it to work in your life, which is really the only, you know, kind of important thing about classes like this. If it doesn't help you with your life, then what's the point, you know? Might as well go and, you know, have a couple of drinks on Chapel Street instead of sitting around in a yoga studio, right? If it's not going to change your life. And I think that's the way, you know, we should consider you know, spirituality in general, religion in general. The Heart Sutra is an ancient text. 300 AD, sometimes they did it too, about 300 AD. Sanskrit, originally Sanskrit, now translated into most of the languages of Asia. It's one of the most popular, it may be the most popular text of all of Buddhism, actually. It got translated into Chinese, it got translated into Japanese, Korean, all the languages of Southeast Asia. And it's chanted regularly by devotees in those countries, and has been for you know, 1,000+ years. But you know, and so we'll go through the Heart Sutra, and we won't just chant it. You know, we'll try to understand it, which is a little bit different than just chanting it. You know, it's kind of good to memorize a text like this and to you know, be able to recite it by heart. Most of us don't learn things that way anymore, which is kind of too bad in a way. It was a kind of a useful thing to be able to memorize stuff. I still can remember stuff that I memorized in grade school, but I don't think they in primary school. I don't think they're teaching kids to do that anymore. And so it's a dying art for us, and that's just not how we learn and retain things anymore. So we learn things by understanding not just, you know, the words, but the meaning. And a text like the Heart Sutra, you know, should have some meaning for our lives, you know. And if it doesn't, then what's the point? You know, if it's not relevant, then I guess the opposite is irrelevant. And what's the point of studying an irrelevant, you know, text? You know, regardless of whether anybody considers it a classic or not. It's got to be relevant. It's got to, you know, make sense to us and make and have the ability to change us, to change the direction of our lives towards a happier life. So that'll be my challenge, is to try to present this text in a way that's relevant to us. And so I'll give it a go. And one way that you can make it relevant, you can help me, is to take the exercises seriously. And to, you know, to go home and actually do something with the stuff that you're sitting here, you know, hearing for an hour and a half or so, for four nights or four sessions for some of you, okay? So actually, these courses are kind of designed ideally to be done over 4 weeks, one class a week with a week of exercise on each class. So, you know, we'll do four classes sort of condensed over the course of a weekend here. But, you know, theoretically, this course could last for a month for you guys, you know, if you wanted to really, you know, get some benefit from it, you know, really make it work for you. We are bombarded with information. We all know this, right? We're bombarded nowadays with information. And we've kind of, in order to survive the info glut, we've kind of learned to how to make it go in one ear and out the other very quickly. We don't retain it. We don't think about, you know, if I ask you what was the lead story in Saturday's Age, you know, probably not many of you could tell me. You know, we just forget it. Just in one ear and out the other, like I said. And it's a shame, you know, it's a survival skill that we all have had to develop. But it would be a shame to have, you know, that kind of attitude towards information that could really change our lives, that could really make for a happier life. And so it's kind of, we have to kind of fight our tendencies
to just think of, you know, classes like this as just another show, you know, just another, you know, bombardment of information that, you know, you may take in and hold for an hour or two and then let it go because something else is coming in, you know, constantly. So, you know, do your best, all right? Do your best to actually take the classes, you know, and what you can glean from, you know, what you think is useful from the classes and put it to work, you know. Put it into your lives. Incorporate it into your lives. And don't just, you know, let it go in one ear and out the other, okay? This is, you know, one of the typical ways that spiritual teachings are organized is around a text. Yeah, when I went to church, I went to church quite a bit when I was a young person, kicking and screaming mostly the whole time. But the sermons were always based on, you know, readings from the Bible, right? The priest or the minister would say, in today's text, today's reading is blah, blah, blah from, you know, the book of whatever. And, you know, the same is true in the Buddhist tradition, in the Hindu tradition, and Eastern traditions in general. They tend to focus on a particular text. And this text is one that has been gone over many, many, many times by many, many teachers. I've done a lot of research on this text, and I can tell you that each and every word of this text has got a commentary on it. You know, you can find a commentary on every single word. And we're not going to do it that way, okay? First of all, you couldn't do it in four classes. You know, you'd take a year. And one could, actually, the text like this. It's kind of like, you know, what I like to call a desert island text. You know, if you were left on a desert island with one text and somebody who could explain it to you, so you're going to have another person there, probably. That would be all you needed. The text alone, without an explanation, probably wouldn't do you much good. It would probably sound like, you know, somebody who had gone on some LSD trip and wrote down their sort of, you know, jottings of their experience. It's quite confusing. Can be quite mysterious, actually. And so it's really crucial to be able to explain it. You know that French term, explication de texte? And this is a text that definitely needs some explication. Yeah. So I won't do it, you know, word by word, but we will try to unpack it a little bit for its meaning. And so, you know, one of the principal ways that this text is understood is kind of as a code. It's like coded. It's like encoded. For some of you might be interested, this is called the Sutra, the Heart Sutra, after all. And Sutra means word of the Buddha. In Buddhism, it's a technical term for the actual teachings of the Buddha, as opposed to later commentaries on the teachings. Okay? And sutra also means a text that is open text to, you know, to anyone who wants to hear it. There are other texts in the Buddhist tradition and in the Hindu tradition also, in the Eastern traditions in general, that are regarded as more esoteric, more closed. In other words, requiring more preparation before you just, you know, kind of open the book and, you know, and read it. And although this text is called the Sutra, it's a funky sutra. And it's sort of on the cusp, you could say, between open and closed, between exoteric and esoteric. And one of the reasons, so there's a little bit of a debate in the tradition about whether or not, it should be closed, actually. It should be tantra. And one of the main reasons for that is that the meaning is not apparent, you know, readily apparent. One of the principal ways that they read this text is as a kind of encoded summary of the five stages of a spiritual life. And you won't find those five stages mentioned in the text at all. I mean, you know, per se. So it's undercover teaching. It's an undercover teaching on the five stages. And we'll go through those five stages beginning tonight. We'll get to stage one tonight. Another reason why the text is sometimes regarded as esoteric and not exoteric, closed and not open, is that it comes to a crescendo with a mantra. Everyone know what a mantra is? It's a, you know, like a spell. Sacred words of power, right? And so almost no other open Buddhist texts have a mantra in them. In fact, one of the names for the secret teachings of Buddhism is Mantrayana. So there's Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, Mahayana, the greater vehicle, and then Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, which is also known as Mantrayana, because the mantras are secret. So this is a kind of a rare text where you get openly a mantra. And those of you who can hang in there, I forget which class it comes in, three or four. I think maybe four. Is it four? I could look, but I'm not going to. You'll get this mantra, okay? You'll get a transmission of a mantra, which is, and then you can say it all you want. I'll give it to you right now, okay? So that you know, if you can't come to the right class, you'll still get it. Okay, say Om.
Om.
That's a universal mantra beginner, opener, okay? You say Om, it means here comes a mantra. Say Gate.
Gate.
Gate. Paragate. Parasangate. Bodhi. Svaha. Yeah, that's the mantra. That's the heart of the Heart Sutra, you could say. So we call this course the Heart of the Heart Sutra. This is what I've heard, finding the heart in the Heart Sutra. And one understanding of what the heart of the Heart Sutra is that mantra. That mantra summarizes the Heart Sutra. So we could all go home now, right? Since you've got the essence, the heart of the Heart Sutra, in a bunch of Sanskrit words that you don't understand. Yeah, so you need some explication de mantra, yeah, as well as the whole text. But in that mantra is the way that mantra is understood is it summarizes the hidden teaching of the Heart Sutra. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangati, bodhi, five paths. Five stages of a spiritual life. And I would argue, and I will, I'll try to persuade you, that these are not unique to Buddhism, these five stages. These are five stages that anyone would go through in their spiritual career. Anyone. And you find versions of them in all the major traditions. And so we'll go through them. That's another way of thinking about the Heart of the Heart Sutra. The Heart of the Heart Sutra is, number one, the mantra, you could say. Number two, it's the five stages of a spiritual life that are encoded in the Heart Sutra. Here's another one. The Sanskrit for this, by the way, is Hridaya, Hridaya Sutra. Hridaya. And the full name, if you look at your reading, you'll see it. I bow down to the Lady, the Realized One, who is the perfection of wisdom, and now for the Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. Hridaya means heart. Sutra means the authentic, authoritative words of the Buddha, which is kind of interesting in this text, because the Buddha doesn't say hardly anything. In fact, he doesn't say anything until everybody else is done saying stuff. Actually, it's one guy. There's two guys who are talking in this, neither one are the Buddha. One guy says a lot, one guy says a question. The other guy says the answer to the question, and then the Buddha said, yep, that's right. No, he does. That's what the Buddha like pops up at the end of the sutra and says, yep, what he said. That's right, what he said. Yeah. So the sutra is supposed to be the words of the Buddha, but the Buddha didn't say the words. And that's kind of interesting in and of itself, and we'll talk about that. So Hridaya, the heart sutra, but it's also the Hridaya, the heart of Prajnaparamita. Prajna in Sanskrit means wisdom, and paramita means perfection. So another understanding of what the heart of the heart sutra is, the heart of the heart sutra, is the heart of wisdom. The heart of what they call the perfection of wisdom. And that's a long story, and it's not really that pertinent. What perfection of wisdom really means, you know, technically. But here's one sort of cut to the chase understanding. The perfection of wisdom is the wisdom that can't be talked about. The wisdom that lies beyond words, beyond concepts, beyond theories and dogmas and doctrines. That's the perfection of wisdom. That's one way of understanding the perfection of wisdom. And so this is the heart of the perfection of wisdom that you can't talk about. So we could all go home now too, right? You say, well, what's the point of talking about wisdom that can't be talked about? And it's kind of a good question, actually. Not a bad question. But, of course, you know, reams and reams and reams of paper has been, you know, has been used up talking about what we can't talk about. The real wisdom of things is not something that you capture like a butterfly and pin into your little collector's item, collector's album, right? You can't just box it in. And of course, the whole history of religion has been one long attempt to box stuff in, right? To put it into categories and containers and orthodoxies and all of that. But in every tradition, you will find a strand, you know, a rather important strand that says you can't talk about wisdom. You can't talk about the real deal. The real realities of things are beyond words, are beyond concepts. The Tao that can be named and talked about is not the true Tao. That's how the Tao Te Ching begins, the great classic of Taoism. Can't talk about it. And this is a very common idea in world religions, actually, that you can't really talk about the true nature of things. The true nature of things lies in experience, direct experience, not in concepts, not in theories. So in the Hindu tradition, they talk about nirguna, or the ultimate reality, or God, or whatever you want to call it, is nirguna, means without qualities, without attributes, without, you know, names and characteristics. Can't put your finger on it, right? Can't talk about it. And it's similar in the Western traditions. The Western traditions in Christianity, for example, there's a whole strand of theology called via negativa, the negative way, which means it's not this, it's not that. God is not this, not that. Anything you say about God, anything you say about ultimate reality, anything that you say about the true nature of things is automatically false, because it's in words, it's in concepts, you see. In the ancient Upanishads, there's a very kind of cool phrase. You can, you know, this is one of the Sanskrit phrases you can remember. Neti, neti. Say neti, neti. Yeah, see, now you're talking Sanskrit already. Neti, not this, not that. It is not this, it is not that. Anything that you say about it is wrong. And then, of course, so you know, the metaphor is that's often used in ancient Indian texts is that all of these doctrines, dogmas, theories, philosophies, ideologies are just fingers pointing to the moon. They're just fingers pointing to the moon. And the point, and then people mistake fingers for moon. You see? The finger is not the moon. The finger's a finger. And then there's like, no, but my finger is different from your finger. They're pointing to the same moon. They're pointing to the experience, you see? The transformative experience of communing with ultimate reality. They're pointing to the same moon. And then, but they're different fingers, and then they have finger wars. That's the history of religion in a nutshell. Yeah, thousands of years of finger wars. Now, we say this thing and you say that thing. They're just words. They're just concepts. Just ideas. You know, human concepts to try to encapsulate what cannot be encapsulated. To try to put into words what is beyond language. So one way of understanding what wisdom is, so this is a kind of a long-winded introduction to the fact that this is a text about wisdom. And one of the things that this text does very nicely, I think, is to deconstruct your ideas. You see, it's, in a way you could say it's not a positive, kind of theory about stuff. It's negative. It's not this, not that. So for those of you who hang on into, you know, tomorrow's classes, you'll start to see a whole laundry list of, you know, of how things don't exist. There is no nose. There is no mouth. There is no eyeballs. There is no this. There is no that. And you go, what? What do you mean? I've got a nose. You know, what is the, what? Well, there is no this. There is no that. There is no Buddhism. There is no Four Noble Truths. There is no, you know, just a negation, over and over again, negation. So, you know, it's a little bit like a guerrilla sniper, in guerrilla warfare, who's just saying, well, what do you guys believe? You know, yeah, what do you think is? You know, not that, not this. Stop holding on and grasping to your little theories, to your little doctrines about what is, you see. Let go, stop grasping. So this is one of the, this is one of our biggest problems in life, is that we grasp. We grasp all kinds of things. And that keeps us from being free. The grasping in and of itself keeps us from being free. You know, how else could it work? Freedom means the opposite of grasping. It means being free. Not grasping to an idea or to a thing or to a person or to an ideology or to an ism, a religion. Not grasping at all, but letting go and being free. So one of the most, kind of controversial of the world religious texts is the one that pries our fingers open from the things that we're grasping to. And the Heart Sutra, I would argue, is of that nature. It's a hand-grasping prior opener. It's a series of negations. It's a series of saying no. No, not that, not this. Nateen, not this, not that. Stop grasping to your concepts and ideas and be free. So it does that, of course, through concepts and ideas. How else could it do it? It does it through language. How else could it do it? How else could it communicate that message of stop grasping to language in any other way than through language? So the heart of the Heart Sutra is very hidden. The heart of the Heart Sutra, you could argue, is not you couldn't put the heart of the Heart Sutra into words. So maybe the subtitle is, is a little... like the Heart Sutra itself. Finding the heart in the Heart Sutra. Well, you can't really find it, in a way. You can point to it. You can point to the moon. But you can't say, the finger is the moon. Okay? All right, so prajna, it's about wisdom. And wisdom is different from knowledge, right? It's an important distinction. And it's certainly different from information. We got lots of information nowadays. Even people without so much knowledge have got a whole lot of information. And neither knowledge nor information brings happiness intrinsically. It's not their function to bring happiness. I used to work in the academic world, and I can tell you, and many of you know this from firsthand experience, at the unis, that there's lots of smart, unhappy people in the universities. They got plenty of knowledge, lots of information. We all got lots of information. You can Google anything, right? But having access to information isn't transformative. It doesn't change you at your core. you know, it makes you smarter or, you know, cleverer or more informed and all of that. But it doesn't transform the soul. It doesn't transform your being, and that's wisdom. Wisdom does that. So wisdom in Sanskrit, prajna, is directly related to the English word gnosis. G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis. And that word comes into an English word that we, you know, use fairly frequently. Gnosis we don't use that much, I don't think, right? Anyone here use the word gnosis a whole lot? Yeah. So, but there is a word that we use that has the gnosis in it that kind of tells us, reveals a little bit about what wisdom is. Prognosis. Prognosis. Prajna and prognosis are direct equivalents linguistically. The pra goes to pro, and the nya in Sanskrit goes to gnosis, prognosis. So prognosis means that you know something in advance, right? It means that you can predict something, right? It's not based on experience. It's not based on the past. Knowledge is based on the past. Information is based on the past. What happened, right? What happened? But prognosis, gnosis, wisdom means what you can expect to happen. What you know will happen, you know? Because it's the way it is. So wisdom tells us the way things are, not the way they happened, or the way, you know, events unfolded or something, but how things really are. And we are unilluminated about that, ordinarily, all of us. We are in the dark about how things really are. We are constantly mistaken, constantly. So the wisdom part of the Hridaya, Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra is to wise us up, is to help wise us up about how things exist and how they don't exist. So let's start with the last one first, because, you know, pretty much it's about how things don't exist. It is implicitly about how things do exist, but explicitly it's about how things don't exist. Things, people, events do not exist independently. Independently. On their own. Okay? Let's just take people, because we're all people here. Never mind things for a second. Does any one of us exist independently of others? In any way at all? Okay? In any way at all. Economically, does anyone exist independently of others? Socially, psychologically, we're all in relationship. In fact, we exist only in relationship. Only. Okay? That's not always clear to us, you know? We hear this little voice inside our head and we think, well, that's who I am. And no one else can hear it. Has that ever happened to you, or is it just me? Who has that little voice in their head, and no one else can hear it, and nobody else really knows who I am. You know, they don't know my thoughts, they don't know my feelings, I'm all by myself in here. Right? That's a very common feeling. And it's driving us crazy, also. You know, it's not a happy feeling to feel like you're all by yourself in there. It's very alienating. Yeah? And so we do our best, our whole lives we do our best to try to overcome that feeling of isolation. That belief that we actually are isolated. You see, it's a false belief, but we still believe it. We think, well, I'm all by myself. So maybe, you know, I'll get some friends, I'll, you know, have some mates, I'll, you know, find a boyfriend or girlfriend, I'll get married, I'll have children, I'll get a pet, you know. Whatever that will, so I won't feel so alone. It is an illusion that you're alone. You have never been alone. See, none of us have ever existed independently of anyone else. We can go through the list. I mean, you know, and if you want to talk about it later, if you want to say no, in this way I'm all alone, we can try it out. You can't be a mother or father without children, right? You can't be a son or daughter without mothers and fathers. You can't be a teacher without students. You can't be a student without teachers. You can't be a plumber unless there are people who need their pipes fixed. See, everything is in relation to somebody else. Every one of the roles that we play in our lives, every one of our identities is in relation to someone else. Only, see? And that's how things do exist. Okay? So, things do not exist, and you don't exist, independently. And we all exist interdependently. Okay? And that's the way it is. That's reality. That's wisdom. Okay? In a nutshell. That's wisdom. And so, you know, we got fancy words for it. Emptiness. You see? This is a whole text about emptiness. Shunya. Shunyata in Sanskrit. Which comes into the English in the word zero. Okay? Zero. So is zero nothing? Does emptiness mean that nothing is there? Zero is an interesting concept. Nil is not null. Okay? Nil isn't nothing. Okay? It makes something possible. Right? Zero makes 10 possible. Without zero, no 10, okay? So before the invention of zero, all you could count up to is 9. And then they got stuck. And they said, well, what do we do now? It was the most expensive you could sell stuff for. How much do you want for that? 9. And then they invented zero. And they said, no, 10 I want. And no, wait, 100. No, 1,000. No, 10,000. See? It makes things possible. Zero. So it's not nothing. And emptiness is like that too. Emptiness doesn't mean that things aren't there or that you're not there somehow. It just means that you're not there all by yourself. You see? It makes, because things are empty, things can exist the way they do. Because we are not independent. We are empty of being independent. So that's another way you can think about emptiness. It means devoid. Void or devoid. Because we are empty of being independent, we do exist interdependently. Thich Nhat Hanh calls this interbeing. You know, the great Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh. Interbeing. We're all in a connection with each other. All of us, you see. None of us exists independently, we all exist interdependently. And that's the case with everything in the world. Everything in the universe, everything in the cosmos. Nothing exists on its own. Everything exists in connection, interbeing, in a nexus of connection. Okay? So zero, emptiness, voidness, is the condition of possibility for how things do exist. If things did not exist, if things were not empty, they could not exist the way they do. Okay? So this emptiness thing is like very confusing to a lot of people. People hear the word emptiness and they go into like some haze, you know? There's some big haze falls over their mind. Oh, empty, where, you know, maybe it's all black somewhere. And, you know, it's a big black hole. That's what they mean by emptiness. And I just fall into the hole. And I don't want to fall into that hole, you see. Right? No, nobody doesn't want to be. Nobody wants to, like, just blip out into some, you know, void. So when you tell people, you know, you're empty, then people, no, I'm not. You know, don't tell me I'm empty. I don't want to be empty. So this is a misunderstanding of what emptiness means. So we'll try to work on that with the Heart Sutra to try to clarify what it means to say that form is emptiness and emptiness is form, which is what you'll hear tomorrow, first class. Which is another way of talking about the Heart of the Heart Sutra. There's a formula that goes like that. Form is empty. Form means appearances, the world of appearance, the world of, you know, of reality, of apparent reality. And so form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Two ways of talking about the same thing. Well, that's even more confusing. So you have to come tomorrow and find that out. Emptiness doesn't mean that things don't exist. But they don't exist, things don't exist the way we ordinarily think they do. Okay? And we don't exist the way we ordinarily think we do. No man or woman is an island. We're all part of an archipelago. Archipelago? Is that what you say? Archipelago? Archipelago? Huge archipelago. That's reality. That's how things are. And everything in the world is like that. There is nothing in the outer world. So, you know, we're talking about the emptiness, what they call the emptiness of the person, of ourselves. But there's also the emptiness of things, the emptiness of phenomena. Nothing out there exists on its own either. Everything is in relation to something else. Everything is in a context, you could say. Everything exists contextually. Nothing exists in isolation. And this is damn good news, okay? This should be really good news. This is wisdom, okay? A little wisdom. In teachings like this, in texts like this, you know, sometimes the commentators say that, you know, and I'll just repeat it, so don't shoot the messenger. But some people are so, I'm kind of trying to avoid the word dumb, are so closed, challenged, intellectually challenged, that they don't have any doubts about things. They hear this kind of stuff and they say, what? You know, they just close down completely. But many of us, hopefully in this room, you know, hear stuff like this and at least it starts to go like, huh? What? You know, a little doubt arises. Things that make you go, wait a minute, So, you know, my metaphor for these kinds of teachings on wisdom is like, you know, you come to class like this, and it's like you have a little sweater, you know, a wool sweater or something like that, a jumper, and it's got, you know, and it's got a little loose thread. You ever have one of those? And you come to a class like this, and this is the sweater of ignorance, okay? The ignorance jumper. And you come to a class like this and you start worrying that little thread a little bit. You start kicking at it. You say, wait a minute. Can things really be the way I ordinarily think of them? And you start worrying that, and little by little by little, the sweater unravels. And it's kind of going to have to be that way. You know, it takes a long time to get any kind of real sensibility, you know, deep down, wisdom, you know, not something that you can intellectually, like, argue about, but some realization that, you know, that the world is not the way it seems, that we're not the way that we seem, that we're deceived most of the time. It takes a long time to get that recognition. I once was very depressed. I got so depressed that I went to a psychiatrist. And, you know, first thing I did when I went to see the shrink was say, well, you know, how long is this going to take? you know, want to get back on my feet again, you know? And, you know, he had the classical response. I think maybe those of you who've been to therapy probably have heard something like this. It took your whole life to get as messed up as you are. It's going to take a little while to get you unmessed up. And that's the case also with wisdom. We spent our whole lives ignorant about the way things really are. So it'll take a little while, a little effort to get unmessed up, to get some kind of, you know, some kind of clarity on how things really are and how they're not. Okay? How they're not. They are empty of being the way we ordinarily think of them. Let me give you another, this is a good example, okay? I like this example personally. Imagine that you have an irritating person in your life. Anyone have one? Is that person independently irritating? Independently irritating means that they have the essence de irritation. Okay? That They are hardwired out there on their own to be irritating. Do we ever think of our irritating people that way? When somebody talks to you about your irritating person, have you ever said, yes, she is so irritating. She is so irritating. She is irritating, right? Independently of what? Of you being irritated. There is no irritating person in the world until and unless what? You see? That's dependence. That's interdependence. That's how things exist. And they do not exist in any other way than that. Ever make that mistake, that kind of mistake that I just talked about? All the time, okay? All the time. Everyone is making mistakes like that all the time. We assign independent essences to things when all they really do is exist interdependently. Interdependently. Let's imagine that you like ice cream. Okay? Ben and Jerry's ice cream? Here in Australia, no? For sale. Chunky Monkey? Do they have that flavor of? So, if you like Chunky Monkey Ben and Jerry's ice cream, ordinarily, you would say, that's good ice cream. That ice cream has the essence of being good, delicious, tasty, right? Is the tastiness in the ice cream? See, that would be an independently existing tasty ice cream. Okay? All by itself out there being tasty. Waiting for you to come and imbibe of its tasty essence. Yes? Is that the way ice cream exists? What's the proof that that's not the case, that Ben and Jerry's Chunky Monkey ice cream exists that way? What's the proof? First of all, not everyone likes Chunky Monkey. Some people like whatever the other flavors are. Okay? Second of all, some people don't like Ben and Jerry's. They like another brand. Third of all, see where this is going. Some people don't even like ice cream. Okay? If the tastiness of the ice cream, Ben and Jerry's Chunky Monkey ice cream, were in the Chunky Monkey Ben and Jerry's ice cream, everyone would like it. Unless you were completely insane. And of course we always say, yeah, if they don't like it, they are insane. That's our four-year-old, you know, kind of in a response to people not agreeing with us about our preferences. You see? The appetizing nature of the ice cream isn't in the ice cream. It's in the taster of the ice cream. Okay? And that's how things exist. They exist interdependently, not independently. Okay? Yeah. And there's just endless examples of this, okay? Endless examples. Because that's reality. That's why there's endless examples, actually. Because reality is pretty much endless. It's just, you know. So everything exists like that, and nothing exists in any other way than that. And that's the whole, that's all we need to know about wisdom, in a way. That is wisdom. That's how things are. That's how things really are. So that's the Heart Sutra. Here we go. I bow down to omniscience. Namo Sarvajnaya. Namo Bhagavataya Tayai Arya Prajnaparamitayai Atta Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. So this is kind of like they're clearing their throats here a little bit. Okay? Now get ready for the Heart Sutra. I bow down to omniscience. Sarvajna. What I just said is omniscience. What I said before I started reading the Heart Sutra, that's all you need to know. Sarvajna. How things exist and how things don't exist is omniscience. Sarva. That's all you need to know. So sometimes people read a word, sarvajna, knowing all things in Sanskrit. So omniscience. Everyone knows what omniscience means. It means shins about omni. It means that you know about everything. And so people hear that word and they go, well, Does that mean that they know the names of all the creatures under the water in the sea? Does that mean they know all the planets in all the solar systems and all the galaxies in the cosmos? Is that what omniscience? This is a computer age version of omniscience. Of thinking that omniscience means that possibly, theoretically, we could be such supercomputers that we would know every single fact. And that's not omniscience, okay? That's a computer age fantasy of omniscience. What would be the point of that anyway, okay? What would be the point? You'd be like Google, I guess, the ultimate Google. Where you just know, like, you'd be the ultimate nerd, okay? That kind of omniscience would be a mega nerd who just had the answers for everything. I know this, I know that, I know this. I know all the data. I get 100 on every one of my quizzes and homework exams, yeah? Not like that. All you need to know is how things exist and how things don't exist, and then you know everything. You know everything that's necessary to know. Omniscience. And if you know how one thing really exists, you know how everything exists. If you know how one thing doesn't exist, you know how everything doesn't exist. Okay? Okay, so all you have to know is like how this glass exists. Does this glass exist independently or interdependently with other objects, with other, you know, is this glass a glass from its own side, independently, self-existently, on its own? See, if it were that, everyone who came into this room would go, there's a glass. Is it possible that somebody could come into this room and not know that this is a glass? Is it possible they could mistake it for, I don't know, a finger bowl? You know? They've seen things like this, you know, where they wash their fingers after a meal or something like that. See? Is it a finger bowl? That's a trick question a little bit, right? Yeah, yes, yes and no. I mean, it depends. It depends. It depends on who's looking at it, how they're viewing it. And that's how it exists. It exists dependent on how it's thought about, how it's used, how it functions. And that changes. That's different in different people, right? That's one way of thinking about interdependence. Here's another way, okay? Is this one thing or many things that I'm holding up in my hand? And the right answer is yes. It depends. It depends on how you look at it. Of course, how many glasses am I holding in the hand? It's one glass, right? Does the glass have parts to it? Is there this little bottom part that stabilizes it when you put it on the table, and then this other part, this stripy part, and then this little flared part? It's very, very fancy glass, isn't it? There are lots of different parts to this glass, right? Top part, middle part, bottom part, right side part, from my point of view, left side part, huh? Lots of parts to it. So how many glasses am I holding? How many things am I holding up? Could you see it as many things? Is it possible to take the perspective on this object and say it's many things? So it depends. That's how the glass exists, dependently on perspective. That's how, and if you know that about one thing, you know that about everything. Sarvajnam. So you can bow down. I bow down to omniscience. I bow down to an idea like that. Okay? That's all. I don't bow down to, like, you know, a mega list of all the creatures that exist underneath the sea. That's stupid to bow down to data. Nobody bows down to data, except for, you know, mega nerds. You bow down to wisdom, how things exist. I bow down to the lady, so Bhagavati here in Sanskrit means the goddess. Wisdom is regarded as female here. Have you heard that before? Is there equivalence in the West?
Sophia.
Yeah, my daughter's name, one of my daughter's name is Sophia. Yeah. It means wisdom. Yeah, from the Greek, I think, right, originally. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting cross-cultural idea that wisdom is female. In the Buddhist texts, in the commentaries on this text, they say, well, prajnaparamita, the long A at the end, indicates a feminine noun. Is a Bhagavati, is a goddess, is a lady, because she gives birth to Buddhas. She gives birth to Buddhas. And as some of you know, wisdom is one half of what they call the two wings of Buddhist teachings. Wisdom and what? Compassion, or more generally, upaya, method. Method. So they say method is like the father. Wisdom is like the mother. All traditions, all sects, all denominations, all religions have the same wisdom. But they have different methods. Okay? So just like there's different names, you know, in a patrilineal society, you have different last names due to your father, right? Father lends you your... So there's, you know, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, Mahayana, Theravada, all the different names for all the different... But the wisdom, the mother is the same. The mother is the same. That's one understanding of why they... It's a feminine, you know, noun here. Here's another one. This one I just thought up, okay? No, I haven't read it in any kind of commentary. In most kinds of understandings, you know, worldwide actually, you know, polarity, right? Male, female, this, that, right? The male is the aggressive side, and the female is the passive side. In most instructions, everyone okay with that? You know, it's not sexist. It's just the way it is. I mean, that's the way it's understood. Wisdom is passive. Knowledge is aggressive. Okay? Knowledge is, you know, getting a bunch of facts and figures and working your will on the world. Wisdom is relaxing about how things are. Relaxing into how things really are. So that's another understanding of the feminine here, okay? I bow down to the lady, the realized one who is the perfection of wisdom. And now for the heart of the... And I guess you've been wondering when we're going to get to the sutra, right? So it says, and now, ata, it's time for the heart of the perfection of wisdom sutra. Evam maya shrutam. Ekasmin samaye bhagavanta jagre viharati sma. Girda kute parvate mahata bhikshu sangena sardam mahata cha bodhisattva sangena. Evam maya shrutam means this is what I heard. This is what I heard. Literally it means thus was heard by me. So colloquially said, here's what I heard. Okay? Who was it that heard this? He's introducing a whole big sutra, and then he says, Evam maya shrutam. Somebody is introducing a whole big, long, you know, deep sutra, and says, number one, doesn't say, you know, I, you know, Henry Smith heard this. So first of all, it's anonymous. We don't know who heard this. And second of all, he says, and this is what I heard. He doesn't say, this is what was said. And that's, you could do a whole course on those three words about reception, you see. Everything is reception. The whole of the history of religion, the whole of spirituality, isn't about what was said, it was about what was heard. What the Buddha said is unknowable to us. What Jesus said is unknowable to us, okay? You know, I was in the academic study of religion, and I can tell you, for those of you who don't know, that for at least 100, 150 years now, scholars have been trying to figure out what Jesus really said. You know? So they scour the Bible, they try to look at every one of his sayings and say, well, is that one of the real sayings, or is that something that somebody else made up later? Somebody else heard, you see? Which did Jesus really say, and which was just heard and added later? And they can't figure it out. There's one criterion that they use. It's kind of interesting. This is a little bit of an aside. Is if it doesn't fit very well, with the sort of orthodoxy that grew up around Christianity is probably real. If it sticks out like a sore thumb, it's probably authentic.
Isn't that interesting? Evam maya shrutam. Doesn't matter what they said. It's unknowable to us anyway. It is what was heard. And that's the case with all of us, okay? See, what I say doesn't really matter. What did you hear? See, when you leave this room tonight, what did you hear? What I said, and I can tell you, having been doing this for a long time, people hear all kinds of stuff that I didn't say. I didn't think I said. You know what I mean? Yeah. You ever had that happen to you? Yeah. Common phenomenon, isn't it? So it's all about reception. What did you hear? What have you heard so far? What will you hear? What will change you, you see? What will matter? You know, Evam maya shrutam, the whole sutra, the whole text is framed in terms of reception, not in terms of what was actually said and transmitted. Very beautiful in a way. Very beautiful. This is what I heard. Once the Lord was, once, and it's ekasmin in Sanskrit, at one time. So we have a phrase for this, once. So then he goes into once, where the Lord means, you know, Buddha. Once the Lord was spending time in Rajagriha. Rajagriha is a town in Bihar, in modern-day Bihar in India, on a mountain called Vulture's Peak, which I actually have visited. The reason they call it Vulture's Peak is there's a big rock that looks like a skull there. That's one reason they call it Vulture's Peak. There's another reason, you know, there's all kinds of reasons. The people that came to Vulture's Peak to hear the Heart Sutra, the people that we'll hear about soon, supposedly took the form of vultures to come there. Flap, 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 and then they all landed and then they popped into human beings. Anyway, once the Lord was spending time in this place in India called Vulture's Peak, together with a whole bunch of other people, great assembly, okay? So, just as we don't know who spoke, really, the Heart Sutra, and in more ways than one, Evam maya shrutam, this is what I heard, but then as we'll find out very, very soon, it's not the Buddha who's even portrayed as speaking the Heart Sutra. It's other guys, under the inspiration of the Buddha, other people speak the Heart. So we don't know who is this text by. Who heard it anyway? Where the hell was it taught? Once, ekasmin. So, you know, one of the more literal and flat-footed understandings of that is, well, it only happened one time. One time, way back when, 2,500 years ago, this thing happened in Northeast India. Or you could say, ekasmin, once, upon a time. What does that do to our understanding of the text? See, when we say once upon a time before we start a story, what time is that?
All time.
Yeah. It's not any specific time. It's not historical, you know, moment. Once upon a time means you've entered into a time that's timeless. Could be any time. Right? You all heard that story? Once upon a time, Little Red Riding Hood was going, you know, to visit her granny, you know, to bring her something to eat. Wasn't it a picnic or something? And she went and saw Granny, but a wolf had eaten Granny and had dressed up in Granny's clothes. And Little Red Riding Hood thought, you know, have you heard stories like that?
Yeah.
And did that really happen? How old was Little Red Riding Hood? What day did she go to Granny's house? How did the wolf, you know, eat her whole like that? And more importantly, how did he get Granny's clothes on? And wander into the bed? And why didn't Red Riding Hood notice that that's a wolf right away? You see, if you start asking questions like that, you miss the whole point. You see? So I would suggest that that's the case with a lot of religious texts too. People miss the whole point by this kind of flat-footed, concretized understanding of things, instead of allowing for the myth to take over. once upon a time, this happened. You see, in a time that is timeless, in a time that could be now.
Evam Maya Shrutam, what did you hear when you heard the Heart Sutra?
In a time that is now, once upon a time. This is what was said, and this is what you heard. Okay?
And that time is now. The Heart Sutra is eternally relevant. That's what it's saying.
In its own text, it's saying, don't box me in, you know? Don't box us in into some historical period, into some flat-footed understanding of who the Buddha is, also. See, who is the Buddha? So this is another one of those.
So we've got all kinds of questions already before even the question. This class will end with the question that the Heart Sutra begins with, really, in a way. This is all just set up so far, but we got all kinds of questions. Evam Maya Shrutam. Who the hell was there? Who are you that heard this? Who? When did this happen? Where? Who was teaching it? And if it's supposed to be the sutra, the teaching of a Buddha, who the hell's the Buddha?
Buddha doesn't say anything in this except for sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, he says it, you know,
class three or so. He says, yep. I think that's pretty much an Australian translation. Yep.
Yeah, nah.
Yeah, yep.
That's all he says. So if this is supposed to be a sutra, then where's the Buddha, you see? Okay, I'll give it away, all right? There's three understandings of what makes a sutra a sutra. What makes it authoritatively the word of a Buddha? The Buddha actually spoke it. Okay, that's number one. The Buddha didn't speak this text, actually. So that can't be how it's a sutra. Number two, he authorized someone else to teach it. And that's sometimes understood as, you know, as happening in this text, as we'll see. Under the authorization of the Buddha, somebody else said the Buddha's stuff. But the third one's even more interesting. And more relevant, I think. Making it relevant, making it real to our lives. The Buddha inspires us to speak. Inspires us. The real Buddha is the inspiration that we all have access to all the time. Okay? Not just way back when in ancient India, long in a place far away and long ago. How's that Star Wars thing go? In a time long ago and in a place far away? Yeah. That's usually how we understand texts like this. You know, like at arm's length, we keep it out here. See, you know, that happened like way back in India to a bunch of Indians, you know, 2,500 years ago. So we don't have to deal with it.
So that we don't have to make it real to our lives. You can keep it at arm's length and you can isolate it. You can keep it tame. You can keep it, like a pet, like a domesticated animal, instead of like a wild beast that comes and, you know, claws your face off. If you don't
make it like yours here now, see, then it can easily become irrelevant, domesticated, tame, and irrelevant. Okay. So who's the real Buddha? Who is the Buddha? What is the Buddha? You know, is it some guy that lived 2,500 years ago in India? Is that the Buddha? So the Heart Sutra is suggesting, no, of course that's not who the Buddha is. And they're doing, so I'll just kind of give you a little historical information about that.
They're doing that in part to justify the legitimacy of a text like this. 300 AD, when did the Buddha live? About 400 or 500 BC.
Okay, so this is 700-800 years after the historical Buddha and is represented as a sutra. As the teaching of the Buddha. Oh, what do you mean? See, and there were a number of people in ancient India who were going, yeah, what's all this new sutras that you guys are generating? Heart Sutra, Diamond Cutter Sutra, where are all these sutras coming from?
And they said, well, you know, from the Buddha. That's what sutras mean. They said, well, the Buddha's been dead for 700 years. What are you talking about?
If you go to some places in Southeast Asia, you go to a Buddhist temple, and some places you'll see footprints. As part of the you know, the iconography of the temple. We were in one in Singapore. Big golden footprints, you know, right as you walk in. Those footprints are pretty interesting, symbolically. It's sort of like, you know, in America there's this expression, George Washington slept here. You know, they try to, like, sell B&Bs that way, you know, like they charge extra money for B&Bs if George Washington was supposed to have slept there. The Buddha was here. You know, look, there's footprints. But what else? Ain't here anymore. Just left behind footprints. See, ain't here anymore. No feet. Just footprints. So texts like this come along, traditions like this come along and say, that's not who the Buddha really was. That's a complete small-minded understanding of who the Buddha is. The Buddha is the air we breathe. The Buddha is the cool breeze on a summer night. The Buddha is the love that you feel when you look into the eyes of your children, you see? The Buddha is the inspiration that makes life juicy and rich. That's who the Buddha is. And that's why this is a sutra, goddammit. No, I mean, that's the argument, right? We don't care about your, you know, dead, footprinted Buddha. The Buddha is a living presence, constantly with us as a possibility. It's not a person. It's a force. It's, you know, it's an atmosphere. Okay? This is a very radical text in a way already, right? At least as I'm presenting it. So here's a bunch of people who gathered together to hear, you know, what the Buddha said. And then what does he do? Right there and then, the Buddha entered into a meditation known as the perfect and deep awareness of the profound. He checks out. I mean, even in the story, you know, everyone comes to hear a big teaching by the Buddha. You know, it's like if you guys all came to, you know, to breathing space here and, you know, start, all sat down and said, like, okay, Maru, start to teach now. And I just go... You know, maybe you'd be disappointed. You know, it doesn't really say that all of them, like, got up and walked out. But, you know, if you are taking it literally, you see, if you're taking it as, like, some kind of newspaper account, like a report, you know, in a newspaper, then there'd be a little hole here, wouldn't there? All these guys, all the great assemblies, not just a little assembly, great, maha, a great assembly, a whole bunch of people show up. And then he just, like, goes into deep meditation. Meditation on the profound means he's meditating on emptiness, for those of you who care. You know, directly, they say. Goes into a direct, you know, perception of emptiness. So he's pretty far out. You know, he's not talking. Okay? He goes into samadhi. That's the text says samadhi. So then what happens? And also at that time, there was fortunately somebody else there. The realized being, Avalokiteshvara. Can you say that? As fast as I did? Avalokiteshvara. Yeah. It's actually Avalokita Ishvara. Ishvara means master in Sanskrit. And Avalokita means the master who looks over things, who oversees. Sometimes in the Tibetan tradition, they translated it by words that came to in English to mean loving eyes. Chenri Zik. Loving eyes. So Avalokiteshvara steps in here now. So all of a sudden we got a different dude. And who the hell's he? And I'll tell you who he is in the tradition. He is what they call the bodhisattva, the saint of compassion. Of compassion. The loving eyes bit, you know? He's got Google eyes for everyone. Like before Google on the internet, there was Google as a verb, I think. When you Google somebody, you know, they kind of like bug-eyed, you know? So he's like, he's got the loving eyes. He just looks at everybody with great love and compassion. Wait a minute, I thought this was about wisdom. Prajna, paramita. And all of a sudden we got compassion sneaking in.
Avalokiteshvara. And actually, it's Avalokiteshvara who teaches, you know, explicitly, the Heart Sutra, under the inspiration of the Buddha. Under the inspiration. So this is also an interesting sort of symbol, right? The one who teaches wisdom is the master of compassion. It's the master of love. And love and wisdom get you to the same place, actually. These are, like I said before, the two wings, one understanding the two wings of a Buddhist practice, wisdom and compassion. And they lead to the same goal, and in much the same kind of way. When you truly love someone, do you feel alienated from them? Do you feel all by yourself? You see? Do you feel a connection? Do you feel the relationship? Do you lose yourself in love? That's wisdom. That's another way of talking about wisdom. Of losing that grasping to the little imaginary you in there that you think exists all by itself in there. Chatting away, right? Complaining usually, okay? And when that little voice inside finally shuts up is when we are happiest and when we are wisest at the same time. The measure of wisdom is the measure of happiness. Exactly, okay? True happiness, deep happiness. If you're not deeply happy, you're not wise. And if you're wise, you automatically are deeply happy. Because they are the same thing. Wisdom and happiness are two ways of talking about the same thing. And wisdom and compassion are two ways of talking about the same thing. Real compassion, you see? Real selflessness. Real connection to others. Or to another. See? Then you lose yourself. And that's reality. See, that's wisdom. That's how it is. The little voice inside is an illusion. It's just an illusion. It's like a dream. It isn't real. What's real is the connections between each other, between ourselves, you see? What's real is the selflessness that interconnection entails. The selflessness, okay? All just nodes in a network. No, nobody all by themselves out there, okay? So we got Avalokiteshvara wandering onto the scene here. The Bodhisattva, the great being, Mahasattva. Mahasattva means great being. Apparently, it was originally a Sanskrit word for lion. Mahasattva, great being, you know, lions are pretty great. And so it then got applied to Bodhisattvas who are supposedly, you know, who are saints, really. Who have dedicated their lives to awakening to the truth of interconnection, interbeing, of realizing that they have never been all by themselves, and therefore have an affinity to all other beings. And so is a kind of a gloss on that kind of mindset is Mahasattva. Awesome. We say an awesome being. Somebody who thinks like that, you see, who's broken out of the shell of their own individuality. Of the illusion of individuality. That's a Mahasattva. So, he also began engaging in the practice. Uh-oh, he's going to go into the same thing. Uh-oh. He began also engaging in the practice of analyzing the profound, the perfection of wisdom. So, wait a minute. Don't you do what Buddha does, or else we're never going to hear the Heart Sutra. So, actually, the verb is different. He doesn't go into samadhi here. He analyzes. Intellectually. It's not a non-conceptual meditation on reality. It's a conceptualized analysis. How do things work? And that, of course, we can put in words. That's why he puts it into words. Okay? And he observed that the five groups are empty of any true nature. Five groups here refers to the five parts of a person. And I think we'll go into that more tomorrow. There's a physical part, there's our body, and then there's five main mental parts. Feelings, the ability to discriminate between things, feelings, discrimination,
consciousness of things, like the visual consciousness of seeing, right? Conscious of seeing things, conscious of hearing things, like that. And then there's this other one called samskaras, which means predispositions, karmic predispositions. So four main mental parts and one physical part. So he says the five groups, the five parts of a person are empty of any true nature. And again, we'll talk more about that tomorrow. Then this other guy shows up. Then the venerable Shariputra. Shariputra means son of Shari. And nobody really knows who she was, but and apparently it was a woman. Sharika is a name for a bird in Sanskrit. So anyway, it just means the son of Shari. The venerable Shariputra, acting under the authority of the Buddha. Buddha Anubhavena. Anubhavena means, you know, authority, power. Said this to the realized being, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being. And then what he says is a question. Okay, and we'll come back to the question in a second. Under the power of the Buddha, this guy, Shariputra, asks a question of Avalokiteshvara. Even our questions are inspired by the Buddha. Anyone have any questions? About the nature of things, about reality, about why things are the way they are? Those questions also are the inspiration of the Buddha. Not just the answers, you see. So sometimes we get that wrong too. It's like, well, if I'm going to be inspired by the Buddha, then I should, like, you know the answers to everything. But here the text is suggesting that the very questions that we ask about, you know, the deeper questions about the meaning of life are also the inspiration of the Buddha. Quite beautiful. That's quite cool. Even the question, and many of us have questions that we can't answer that easily. So, you know, it's not a matter of being inspired to just, you know stuff for sure, but to be thinking, see, to be wrestling with the big questions in life, not just have pat answers to them. Oh, you know, inspire me Buddha so I know the orthodoxy, so I know the dogma of how things are. Inspire me to think. Inspire me to wake up a little bit and investigate the world around me instead of, you know, walking through it sleepwalking, see, on automatic pilot my whole life. So if you're fortunate enough to have questions arise. What's the meaning of it all? What's the point? What am I doing here? Why do bad things happen to good people and vice versa, you see? Is there a God? And if so, you know, how come she's like ignoring us so much? You see, why are we left to our own devices so much? Is it right? These are the big questions. Those are inspired by the Buddha, he says. Yeah? Kind of by implication. Shariputra asks a question. His big question is this. If a son, any son of a good lineage, okay, and it does say son, and as we'll see in tomorrow's class, the Buddha corrects him. Not the Buddha, Avalokiteshvara, inspired by the Buddha, says son or daughter. Okay, but it's only in the answer. The question is, if any son of a good lineage, Kula Putra, the son of a Kula, the good lineage here doesn't mean, you know, a sort of ordinary family, but it means when you've joined a larger family, when you've become a saint, when you become a bodhisattva, and have identified yourself with a larger family, not just your blood family. Okay? So if someone like that wanted to engage in the practice of the profound, like the Buddha over there is doing, you know, Buddha's just sitting there, you know. Hopefully he's learned to keep his mouth closed. In meditation, it's important to keep your mouth closed in deep meditation, because if you don't, you know, you start dribbling and stuff like that. And that would have been a little bit embarrassing with the Buddha in front of the great assembly. He's out, man. He's just, you know, he's in outer space. He's in a deep meditation. So if somebody, you know, a bodhisattva, a son of a good lineage, wanted to engage in a practice of the profound, of understanding things, the perfection of wisdom, what would he need to learn? What would I need to learn once I've decided that I want to try to understand the nature of reality, having gotten a certain amount of compassion, love in my heart, you see? That's what a bodhisattva is, somebody who identifies with others, not just themselves, you see, not just isolated by themselves. So what would I need to know about reality once I've gotten there? Remember I told you that the text is about the five paths? Five paths of a spiritual life. We just got to number one, okay? There are many, many different understandings of where the five paths are, but one of them is, Shariputra would have only asked this question if he had reached path number one. So what is path number one? This is, you know, like I said, these are... I think a better English translation for marga, path, and, you know, might be pathway. Like we talk about pathways forming in our minds, the way the neurons fire or something like that, fire in different pathways. So when the neurons start firing in a certain pathway, you've gotten to, you know, one or another of the stages that we're talking about. So Shariputra's pathways start firing differently, and he reaches stage number one. Stage number one is called the path of accumulation. Sambara in Sanskrit. Sambara marga. The path of accumulation. And the way that any of us will get to this stage, you know, maybe I don't know who you are, maybe you're already on this stage, is to give up thinking that the point of life is just making a bunch of money, buying a bunch of things, going through serial relationships, going to endless dinners out on the town, being a foodie, drinking, you know, vintage wine, going on holidays, and then getting old and die. Called renunciation. Okay? That doesn't mean that you can't do any of that stuff that I just said. It's fun to do that stuff. Yeah. It's fine. It's good. Nice to have good lattes. Okay? You can still have your lattes, all right? You can still go to the, you know, fancy Thai restaurant. You can still go to Bali. You can still, you know, have fun. But not think that the whole purpose of life is in those things. Okay? The spiritual life begins when you wise up about the fact that there's more to life. Okay? And does not begin before that. You see? There are a lot of people who aren't here. There are a lot of people who are, you know, on Chapel Street, living it up. And that's fine, you know, I'm not judging them at all, okay? But it seems like there are a lot of people, you know, ourselves included, maybe much of the time, who think that that's the whole point. That's the whole point of life. And people like that, people when we're like that, are immune to a spiritual life. It doesn't even begin, you see. Because, you know, what's the point? Why should I? Everything's fine. Right? The economy's good. There's so many good restaurants here and theaters and movies in 3D. There's so many cool places I can travel with my strong Australian dollar. See? Why worry about stuff? Until what? Until you have to. Until the bubble bursts. And the bubble will burst on every one of us. Okay? In one way or another, it's going to burst. So that's life. That's the reality of life. The reality of life is that there are problems. There's suffering. There's difficulties. And it's not just for other people. See? There's two positions that we could be in. That we are in. Only two. We're in a disaster, or we're between disasters. And all of us have been in a disaster. There's nobody here, like, you know, young enough to not have faced major disasters in their life. Losing a loved one, having your career tank, you know, whatever it is. Losing your health, having a major, like, you know, relationship disappointment. So we're all suffering like this. And then what, you know, and a certain number of us in this room are in the middle of a crisis like this right now. And for those of you, you know, I'm not happen to be in one right now. But for those of you, if you are one, you know, now you know, you see. Now the scales have fallen from your eyes. What did you think? That this kind of thing would never happen to you? That it only happened to other people somehow? See, what do we think? And that's ignorance. That's another kind of way of thinking about ignorance, that we're somehow protected, or that we should have assurances that these kinds of things wouldn't happen to us. And then they do. And they do. And then, you know, and then we struggle with them, and we, you know, we try to get back on our feet and all like that. And then when we, you know, survive, if we do survive, you know, some tragedies are big enough so that you don't survive them. But if you do get back on your feet, and, you know, so, then we go into this kind of marijuana narcotic haze. We say, oh, that was bad. That was a difficult time I had last year. But now I'm feeling better. I'm out of bed a little more, you know, back on the job once in a while, and, you know, putting my life back together. And then what, you see? Then what's the unspoken? And maybe that won't happen to me. You see, maybe that kind of thing won't happen to me anymore. Maybe that was it for disasters, for me. What do you think? So a person who, like, starts to wise up about this kind of, you know, this is what life has got in store for us, you see, for every one of us. It's not just some people. We are all universally susceptible to suffering. If we're not in the middle of it, the clock is ticking. Universally, okay? And nobody's got more claim to suffering than someone else. Suffering is subjective. It's not objective, okay? You can't measure it. You can't say, well, you know, I've got 7.4 suffering and you only have 5.6 suffering. So I got more suffering than you somehow. See, we're all suffering. We're all in deep doo-doo here, you see? And the nice on the town, the foodie culture, the 3D movies, that's not going to help your suffering. That's not going to save you from suffering. See, it's a diversion. Okay? There's nothing wrong with it. Okay, but to put all your hopes in it and think, well, this is how I will get through life happily. It's just, you know, it's just indulging myself as much as possible. It's a fool's game. So path number one begins when you wise up about that kind of thing. And you say, well, you know, what will really work then? You know, what will really help me to deal with life? To deal with the ups and downs of life, you see. Not just the ups, but also the downs. What will really help me? And that's what the spiritual life does. That's the business the spiritual traditions are in, is providing you some safety net for when you fall off the wire. And you will fall off the wire. You've fallen off before, you climb back up onto the type wire, now you're sitting there precariously balanced, you know, trying to get to the other side safely, but you're going to fall. We all fall. See? Not just some people. Not just only once in life or something like that, and now it's over and I'll never have to face difficulties again. So Shariputra asks the kind of question that somebody who, like, realizes that kind of thing would ask. So what do I need to know now, you see? Now that I've figured out that, you know, that the secular life, in and of itself, is not going to help me, save me, you see. What do I need to know that will really help about how reality really is, okay? So that's the question. He pops the question there at the end. And the rest of the sutra is the answer. The rest of the sutra actually it comes in two parts. There's the prologue, so that's not the rest of the sutra, that's what we already covered. The prologue, which kind of ends in the question. Popping the question. See, Shariputra asks Avalokiteshvara his most pressing question. Then there's the answer to the question, and then there's, so that's the second part, the answer to the question that Avalokiteshvara gives. Then the third part is when the Buddha pops up again out of deep meditation and says, yep, nah, yeah. And then the fourth part is when everyone has a big party. So the great assembly goes, yay, yay, right on, okay?
So that's how the whole text is structured. The exercise that I've suggested for this class is on the next page after the thing. And I'll just like summarize it. You can read it later. But it's to ask yourself the big questions. If you're like, you know, if you're like me and many other people, you know, you've gone through a whole lot of your life not asking those big questions. Maybe you asked them when you were young. I think young people tend to ask them, right? When you're in your teens or early 20s, you ask questions like, well, what's the point? What's the meaning of life? You know, what am I supposed to do with my life? Questions like that, you know. Is there a God? You know, does it matter if there's a God? Or, you know, big questions. But then we go, you know, we get busy. You know, grown-ups get busy. And we start having our families, and we go to work and our careers, and we stop asking the questions. So your exercise, you know, should you choose to do it, it's like Mission Impossible or something like that. Your mission, should you accept it, is to ask some big questions this, you know, for this class, you know, hopefully for a week, you know, to just take a few minutes every day and to revisit the big questions that are on your mind. Maybe they're not the same question that Shariputra had, but what is yours, you see? What's your big question? And to, you know, to not only pose it, but to struggle with it a little bit. Time's running out, you. Life is short. And, you know, going through life just sort of spacing out on the big questions of, you know, what life is all about and what's the purpose and all like that is kind of a waste of life in a way. It's kind of chuckle-headed. You know that term? Chucklehead. Just goofball. Just a, you know, goofy way of living, not thinking about, you know, the deep questions of life. So that's the exercise. And tomorrow we'll pick up with the answer that Avalokiteshvara gives to Shariputra's big question. How should I live? You know, it's many of the classics of world literature, including, you know, secular literature, are about this same question. How should I live? To be or not to be, you see. That is the question. What should I do? Diamond Cutter Sutra also begins this same kind of lots of texts. Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna said, Arjuna asked Krishna, you know, what am I supposed to do here? And in a way, you could say that's Shariputra's question, too. What am I supposed to do? Now that I've wised up a little bit on the path, of, you know, gotten to this pathway of accumulation, now I've wised up a little bit about the vapidity of, you know, all the things that we cling to you know, to prevent suffering for us. You know, now I've wised up a little bit about that. What should I do? How should I live? So that's his question. And that's a pretty good question. It's a question that has been posed, you know, for millennia in the literature of the world, the great literature of the world. So why shouldn't we, you know, pose it in our own lives? A little bit at least, you know? At least for a week maybe, okay? Then you can forget about it, have some lattes. Why don't you pose the question while having a latte? How's that? All right, that's all I have to say tonight. Unless there are questions, if there are questions or comments. Yeah, Malcolm.
I'll let you drink first.
You can talk while I'm drinking.
I missed your interpretation of Shariputra.
Putra means son. And Shari, you know, nobody seems to know really who Shari was. There's a word Sharika in Sanskrit that means a kind of a bird. So she's... And I think it is usually assumed to be a mother. So it's kind of an unusual name because it's, you know, usually the putra, the son, is of the father. But Shariputra is the son of Shari, who's named after the bird, Sharika. That's the best I can do.
Son of a bird.
Other questions? Have to be inspired by the Buddha. Have questions, that's right. Well, I bet you'll have more questions tomorrow. If you come tomorrow, we'll have more questionable things. Wasn't enough questionable things today, I guess, tonight. All right, so thank you for coming. And those of you can join us tomorrow, 12:30 is the next class. And hope to see some of you here. Okay, thank you.